Hello, good evening, welcome. I am Samuel Trapp. This is Damn Radio. You happen to be listening to, and you're listening to the show International Flavor. I'm a little bit grumpy today. I heard an article. I watched a video, and I want to play it for you. And some of you may not agree with the. The topic of it all, with the seriousness of it all, but it actually bears a lot of fruit when you think about it. I want to get to today. I spent some time in the sauna, Russian bathhouse, the banya. Every time you go there, there's lots of Russians and Russian speaking people. And today was an interesting day. I had an interesting conversation with someone that kind of, I usually don't give my opinion out, except on a station that you can turn off if you like. And when I'm in a bathhouse with a bunch of Russian speakers and they find out that I'm American, it's like I'm a, I don't know what, unique little item. And so they ask me my opinion on what I think of the war and what I think of Putin. And of course, it happened today. And it was an interesting story, and we'll get to it. But I think that this bears some paying attention to. It's a little bit tongue in cheek, but take it for what it's worth. It's only 10 minutes, and I may let it all play. Because it was, in my view, this is a reality. It's like we won as the U.S. This is a big win for the U.S., but it's game as usual for the rest of the world, and not a good thing. Well, arguably not a good thing for Ukraine. And it's called BlackRock Wins Inside the Signed Secretive U.S.-Ukraine Mining Deal and Its Consequences. Believe it or not, look into it yourself, okay? But it made me interested in knowing more, okay? Anyway, here it goes.
Welcome back, everyone. Thank you so much for joining me today. Thank you for being here. It is official. Ukraine is now an economic colony of the United States. In other words, Ukraine officially surrendered its economic sovereignty to a foreign actor. Thanks to Zelensky, generations of Ukrainians will never have an opportunity to own their natural resources, let alone use those resources for the benefit of their children. Today, we unpack a groundbreaking and very controversial new agreement between the United States and Ukraine that gives Washington privileged access to Ukraine's natural resources, including aluminum, graphite, oil, and gas. The United States and Ukraine signed what Scott Bessent called a historic deal. And you know what? He's not wrong. It is indeed a historic deal. Never before in the history of Europe did an illegitimate leader of a state, of a country, sign over nation's resources to the country that used it as a proxy against its adversary. Never before. Here is Secretary of Treasury Scott Bessent enjoying the honor of making the announcement. Please take a look.
Thanks to President Trump's tireless efforts to secure a lasting peace, I am glad to announce the signing of today's historic economic partnership agreement between the United States and Ukraine, establishing the United States-Ukraine Reconstruction Investment Fund. This partnership allows the United States to invest alongside Ukraine to unlock Ukraine's growth assets, mobilize American talent, capital, and governance standards that will improve Ukraine's investment climate and accelerate Ukraine's economic recovery. The Development Finance Corporation will participate and help to establish this fund in collaboration with the government of Ukraine. Today's agreement signals clearly to Russian leadership that the Trump administration is committed to a peace process centered on a free, sovereign, and prosperous Ukraine over the long term. It's time for this cruel and senseless war to end. The killing must stop, and both the United States and the government of Ukraine look forward to quickly operationalizing this historic economic partnership for both the Ukrainian and American people.
On the surface, it looks like an economic partnership to support Ukraine's war-torn economy. But look closer, and what emerges is a strategic, high-stakes power play, one that could redefine post-war Ukraine, shift the trajectory of U.S.-Russia tensions, and also raise serious questions about economic sovereignty. So let's dive into what this deal really means and what no one is saying out loud. On Wednesday, the United States and Ukraine signed an agreement that grants the United States privileged access to major Ukrainian resource projects. Think energy extraction, mining rights, and investment channels. That includes the development of strategic materials like graphite and aluminum, essential for modern tech and defense systems. It also covers oil and natural gas, commodities that could give Ukraine, and by extension, the United States now, leverage over European energy flows in the long run. A special reconstruction investment fund will be established, and here's the key detail. The United States will control the fund. So anyone who says the deal is good for Ukrainian people, anyone who says that should just give up the ownership of their bank account and just let their worst enemy become the owner of their bank account and see how that feels. If someone else controls an asset, you don't get to call it yours. It's as simple as that. Washington gets first claims on profits, a move officially framed as a way to reimburse future military support. But let's be real, it also means Washington now has economic influence over Ukraine's post-war recovery and whether it even happens. Why is this happening now, you may ask? Well, President Trump is under pressure, of course. His poll numbers are slipping. They're not doing very well. And this is due to American people disapproving of his economic policy. Only 30%, according to Reuters, of the surveyed individuals approve of his policies. So it is quite low. And he is eager for a foreign policy win, especially with ceasefire talks between Ukraine and Russia and the United States stalling. By signing this minerals deal, Trump accomplishes three things, and I'm going to just spell out those three items. The first one is he secures U.S. business interests in Eastern Europe, particularly in a post-war Ukraine, whatever's left of it anyway, which is rich in underdeveloped resources. The second win is Trump signals U.S. commitment to Ukraine, which of course boosts leverage in ongoing peace talks and especially allows him to have a better relationship with Zelensky, who refuses to have any negotiations, any meaningful negotiations. And the third benefit here is Trump buys time and he buys goodwill from Kyiv regime, making Ukrainian concessions in ceasefire talks more politically palatable, of course. Let's be blunt, this is not about rebuilding Ukraine. This is about ensuring U.S. dominance in the region long after the conflict ends. In the clip that I showed you earlier, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent claimed this deal shows U.S. commitment to a free, sovereign, and prosperous Ukraine. But when the United States controls the investment fund, holds first claim on profits, and sets conditions for mining access, can we still call this sovereignty? No, we can't. The answer is clear. Ukraine's economy minister said that this fund will, quote, attract global investment. But under what terms? And who really benefits? She failed to mention. Yes, Ukraine will get foreign capital. Yes, American companies will invest. But this looks less like partnership and more like strategic leverage that is wrapped in the language of economic aid. Ukrainians will not benefit because they won't own anything. They will be cheap labor force working in those mines because they have no other options. They're not the owners on their land. Remember how Africa was exploited? This is a rinse and repeat. Now it's Ukraine's turn. And while Washington dropped its demands that Ukraine must repay their past aid, it ensured that it will profit from the future military support. That's not charity, it's conditional capital. This agreement is as much about Russia, of course, as it is about resources. By embedding itself in Ukraine's reconstruction, the United States sends a signal to Moscow. America isn't just supporting Ukraine militarily, it's there to enjoy anything that Ukraine has to offer, economically, politically, permanently. But it's also a signal, of course, to European allies, many of whom fear being sidelined in Ukraine's future. They want a cut too. They want a piece of the pie. With EU accession still in Kyiv's agenda, this US deal could actually create friction. Can Ukraine really balance American economic dominance and European integration? Or will it have to choose a side? That remains unknown. Remember, Trump has already threatened to walk away from a ceasefire from the peace talks if there is no progress. And this deal may be Zelensky's insurance policy to keep Washington at the table, especially since Zelensky is desperate to continue the proxy conflict despite heavy losses. After all, he knows that his family is safe somewhere in Europe, and his children won't be the ones paying for his choices. It's a win-win for him. It's also worth noting how much political drama surrounded this deal. Earlier this year, talks fell apart after a clash between Zelensky and Trump. It took a surprise one-on-one meeting between Zelensky and Trump at the Vatican, of all places, no less, during the funeral of Pope Francis, to salvage the agreement. That optics alone speaks volumes, doesn't it? Behind the headlines, diplomacy has been strained, personal, and very transactional. And Trump himself, in his typical style, bragged that American presence will keep bad actors out. And what's the translation of that quote? It could be U.S. boots, or at least companies on the ground in Ukraine will keep actors out, will keep Europe out, therefore. This isn't just economic access, it's a strategic footprint. So who benefits? The United States, without a doubt. American companies get access to critical resources, virtually at no cost. The government secures influence in post-war Ukraine. Also, Trump wins, politically, for now at least, as he claims a win on peace and investment. Does Ukraine benefit at all? I would argue that it's a historic loss. Thank you for watching. I hope this video was interesting and informative. Drop a comment below. Is this deal a necessary step toward peace?
I think it's a bad step. I'm not a fan. Now I'm a fan as far as America goes. I mean, we get a rape, kill, pillage, and burn. Eat babies. I remember that from the army days. No, but we get a and rape in the figurative sense, not in seriousness. We are doing the same. One of the biggest things I agree with in her monologue there was the exploitation of Ukraine, not for the benefit of Ukraine. Now, arguably, growth benefits Ukraine and American investment benefits Ukraine, but where's the money going? Money's going to the same old people. This is a huge win for the old standard deep state arms control, large, big money. I guess I would have to say the billionaires club is what this is. This is not about Ukraine. This is about I'm not totally against it, because the U.S. this is good for the U.S. You know, this is good. It is a Trump victory, but it's business as usual, the same old thing. And since Trump is the one in office when this is taking on, he gets to pick the winners instead of picking the winners. But since Rubio's involved in this, maybe Rubio gets to pick the winners. It's clear that Bessent was going with the same old deep state, big ticket items. You know, we want the U.S. investors. You want the same old crowds in there doing the same old thing and taking anything you can get. I think we should get our money back. I think I'd like to read the deal also when they finally publish the whole thing. I haven't seen the whole thing. Maybe JR has seen it, but I'd like to see it. And frankly, here this is going to sound cold and harsh. Part of me wants to jump on board. Part of me wants to go, oh yeah, hell yeah, I'm all for it, like everybody else in the standard government contracting schemes is gonna do. This is the next big boondoggle where buttloads of cash pour out of the government and into Ukraine through U.S. buying in with big corporations and hoping to get their, you know, their development corporation, the development finance corporation, and who their partners are. If you go to their website, by the way, United States International Development Finance Corporation. Okay. Who we are, DFC partners with the private sector, it says, to advance U.S. foreign policy and strengthen national security by mobilizing private capital around the world. But it's always the same old people. Who we are. DFC is America's development finance institution. It's either the same old people here or, even worse, the same old people there. The same old corrupt people who run Ukraine are going to be the same old people benefiting from the money that we pump in there through the Development Finance Corporation. Same old thing. This replaces U.S. Agency for International Development money, which I suppose we can say that we're positive on that, that it isn't just handing it over to NGOs and letting them have it through the same old, but it's the same old people through the Development Finance Corporation. Trust me, they're all connected, and they suck off the same big old government teat, right? That's what they do. It's a big old nipple, and they are latched the hell on, and they aren't coming off. DFC was established through the Build Act with bipartisan support during President Trump's first term, building on the need for increased private sector investment in emerging markets, enhancing U.S. global economic leadership, and countering China's presence in strategic regions. Okay, but it's the same old thing: conditional lending. You do for us. You know, it's here is where it comes from. Is DFC part of the U.S. government? Yes. It's a U.S. government agency. That alone ought to scare the shit out of you, pardon my French. Our board of directors include the U.S. Secretary of State, Treasury, and Commerce, as well as representatives from the private sector. Same old people. There it is. Same old folks. How does it provide grant-based, or does it provide grant-based foreign aid? That answer is no. It makes loans, investments, and provides insurance against political risks and helps private businesses grow in other countries. Now, this is the part of me that wants to say, oh, well, I'm in. I'll go over there. You know, I'd be happy to do it. But that wasn't the show tonight. We actually have a caller coming in tonight, and he's going to join us on, and this is the time for that. Hello, caller. Are you with me?
Yep, I sure am.
Well, I'm very glad to hear you. Very glad you're participating. People, I wanted to introduce Matthew Von Trapp, and we're going to continue on last week's discussion, which was very intriguing and somewhat enlightening for me. A couple of issues there. And you know what, Matthew, I was just talking about, and before you get started on what I asked you on to continue, what do you know about the new, if anything, about the new minerals deal that Ukraine has signed away to the United States. What do you know about that, and what are your thoughts on it, if any?
I don't know the particulars of it. I will say it's an interesting dynamic that we're seeing. Back in the day, the U.S. was accused under Bush, wrongfully so, I might add, of going into Iraq just for the oil. And now we're to a time in society where it's like, hey, what are we getting out of the deal? You know? So I think the shift is interesting. I'll withhold comment on the actual contents because I haven't seen it. But I do know that what was spoken of before is that U.S.-led companies will be able to go in there and set up shop, and they'll have to build some infrastructure, which will benefit, obviously, the locals. And I think there's even a benefit. What Trump was trying to do is get a benefit for the Russians as well for their minerals on the world market to try to get everybody to the table over money. So,
well, it seems to be the only thing that'll bring everybody to the table is money. So I'm not against it. I don't see it as anything positive for the average Ukrainian, except to the extent that it helps to rebuild their country, which if we hadn't have pushed it, would have never needed rebuilding anyway. So yeah, well, I'm a little bit with Trump on that one. This is a war that shouldn't have happened.
At this juncture, everyone needs an exit strategy. Mm-hmm. And these guys, what was that Dr. Seuss book? Wasn't it called The Lorax or something, where there's two of these things standing in the middle of an open desert, and they refuse, they're both, one's walking east, one's walking west, and they refuse to move around each other, and then time goes on and the whole city's built around them. But there's no point to the war. And I think if we look back at since Korea, there really haven't been a point to wars, and except for to make money, etc. We'll get into that a little bit tonight with the Bush family. But that type of ideology of, and when I say there isn't a point, I mean we're not doing what we used to do. It used to be all out war. The reason you go to war is because there is a question about who is going to win. That's why you go to war. Because one's like, nah, I can go to war, and the other's like, I'm going to beat you, and I'm going to set the policy. So we used to, when we were doing total war, we would go in somewhere and just wipe everybody out, force political change, rewrite history, and that was that. Like, you're going to do it. Now we go in, we set up camp, we've got people that make money, we develop and test weapons. We do some social engineering and some economic engineering for our own. And after Bush, we were doing also technological engineering for police surveillance. And that's the way war is fought. So when you look at what Trump's doing, it's definitely a departure from the status quo.
That's an interesting perspective. I have a bit of a different take, but I won't go into that. Let's get into your continuation from our last visit. That was very interesting to me, and I want to hear more about the Bush connection, and if we get to what we originally were going to talk about, the 9/11, that would be kind of cool too. And it's like you had said, in our last conversation, if you started your thinkers club, and that thinkers club, you know, maybe whatever you said, 20% maybe of the folks were thinking that it could have been an inside job, and at the end of the discussion on it, everybody thought that it was likely an inside job. Why don't we begin with your thoughts?
Well, and just to set the stage tonight, I don't know how far we'll get into it. I know we're on a time schedule, but I think this is definitely the next step. This what we're going to discuss tonight. To start with, I want to just throw out there that we really only have one choice in this life, and everything builds off of that choice. And that choice is what to believe. You believe you're fat, you may go on a diet. You believe you're stupid, you may go get education. You believe you need money, you might go get a job. You believe in God, you'll do X, Y, and Z. You don't believe in God, you may just go do, you know, X, Y, Z, and some other stuff. At the end of the day, everything we do is driven by belief. So what I'm about to put out here tonight, I'm not expecting everybody to believe, and I really don't care. And I don't know exactly what to believe in every instance. I'm just looking at the perceptions. I'm going to throw out there some of the things that have happened, what we're looking at, and then everybody can choose what they want to believe. And if they want to, you know, they want to believe something that makes them feel good and be able to sleep at night, more power to them, right? I think everybody's seen that show, Life of Pi. If you haven't, I highly recommend it. But it's basically about a guy who has a terrible experience and decides what he wants to believe about it. And so what I'm saying tonight is along the same lines, and especially as we get into stuff about 9/11 and those kind of things. So having said that, let's talk, I'll just briefly go over what we talked about last week. Mm-hmm. One, there's an American world order that starts in 1945-46 with the defeat of all of our enemies, and the U.S. rises. We've got Bretton Woods agreements, and there's organizations put into place to manage the global currency. Those global organizations still exist. And with that comes a new dawning of the way things are going to be in the world. We see technological advancements. We see all kinds of things, military doctrine changing, etc. And over the course from 1945 to 1995, most of that remains the same as far as doctrine goes. As we start looking at the Bill Clinton era, and just before Bill Clinton, we know that at the latter end of like the late 80s under George H. Bush, that's the time when most people say, hey, that was the peak of America. So we're in decline, right? We've had a rise. We're now declining. And what do we do? So again, in summary, there's different responses to this. George H. Bush, his response to the problem of the decline was, well, my family is not going to lose power, and neither are the other rich white dudes that are hanging out in the UK and anywhere else. We aren't going to give in to the Chinese or anybody else. So we need a new world order. We need something where it's not just one nation replacing another over time. We need something that's stable. So George H. Bush has been mentoring a young governor. Well, before he became governor, he was mentoring a young upstart by the name of Bill Clinton. Mm-hmm. And he helps Bill Clinton move through the political ranks. Some would argue that he helped him become president. And then there's a start and a shift in some of the policies. We start seeing a shift towards globalism. Now, we saw it a little bit under George H. Bush when he went down to Panama, took a sitting president, threw him in jail in Florida. And then he also went after Saddam Hussein. So there's these kind of things, right? So we see changes after Bill Clinton. We see George W. Bush. We see then Barack Obama. And I would say that basically all three of those people are of the same mindset. Many of them are in the same clubs, right? When we were talking about Bush v. Kerry, they're both members of the Skull and Bones. They both have the same ideologies. It's just, you know, which flavor of popsicle do you want? Because you're going to get the popsicle. You can just look, you know. But they go through and they change a bunch of stuff. And America changes. And now Trump, who for the last 40 years has been talking about tariffs and about all these other things, Trump, RFK, all these guys who are Kennedy Democrats, they switch to the Republican Party and they take control and they say, we're going to switch it all back. So that's a summary of last week.
Yep.
And the question I asked was, how much change can an organization, I don't care if it's a Boy Scout troop or a corporation, how much change can it face and still be the same organization? Right. And what I postulated at that time was that the United States is fundamentally different than what it was. We have new questions in front of us that we have to answer, like what the global order is going to look like. And so it's a different time right now. So that's the summary. Anything I miss or?
I don't think so. No.
All right. So now let's go back and let's take a look at the key figures of 9/11 and some of these other things. Well, we find the Bush family and we find a lot of the friends of the Bushes. And I think it's important to note that the Bushes, the Cheneys, including father and daughter, the Clintons, who am I leaving out? Barack Obama. They all threw their weight behind Kamala Harris. So that's not just because they don't like Donald Trump. Ideologically, it was their only choice. Kamala Harris believes in, so again, the summary of last week is that we're shifting power to a global entity to absorb the United States going defunct. In the meantime, if you know you're going to file bankruptcy, it's like Dumb and Dumber when they're walking out of the restaurant where they're just taking stuff because it's getting charged to somebody else. And that's exactly what we see happening across America. Cash is just flowing to everybody's friends, all kinds of crazy spending. Like we're completely unhinged from any type of fiduciary.
Yeah, no responsibility of any kind, none.
Yeah, and we don't care because we know, hey, we're just going to print this into oblivion. It's all going to collapse, right? This is what they're doing, right? They don't care. So meanwhile, Trump is saying, no, we're just going to prevent the downfall of America. It's going to be a new day. We're going to have a new economy. We're going to have new values and morals. We're going to be a powerhouse, et cetera, et cetera. And everybody's like, oh, crap, I was really counting on this global organization now because we get all kinds of power, and now who's this clown, right? So let's go back and talk about, well, specifically the Bush family in all of this. When we go back in time, we first have to look at Prescott Bush. He's the father of George H. Bush and the grandfather of George W. Bush. So he was a prominent banker. He served as director of the Union Banking Corporation, which was linked to a German industrialist by the name of Fritz Thyssen. And he was a very early and ardent supporter of Adolf Hitler. Okay. But yeah. In 1942, the U.S. government seized Union Banking and a couple of other businesses, I might add, under the Trading with the Enemy Act, citing its connection to Nazi Germany. So there was a little bit of money laundering going on. So why is this important? Prescott Bush, he was friends with the Brown brothers, and he had networks that were very close in, they were very much active in creating the CIA, right? And this is important because they went to the government and they would say, hey, here's why we need the CIA, right? We need this, not just a clandestine organization, but we need this kind of extra governmental power. And, you know, then we can, you know, do stuff that's important.
Well, yeah, without telling anybody.
Without telling anybody. Well, yeah. Who's the first people in that organization? Well, we find in the early 60s, right, we've got the Bay of Pigs invasion, and it's headed up by the CIA. Now, who is in that? So George H. Bush, his oil company, Zapata Offshore, it had connections to the Bay of Pigs invasion. It was their ships. One of the ships was named the Barbara, just like his airplane was. He wasn't really good at clandestine activities, I don't think. There are several researchers.
Or he was so arrogant that it didn't matter.
Yeah. So there are several researchers that suggest that Zapata's offshore drilling activities provided cover for CIA missions and extra funding if they couldn't get it from certain places. They started, you know, selling oil on the market and then using that. Who planned the Bay of Pigs? Well, we've got George H. Bush, Lyndon B. Johnson, Gerald R. Ford, John F. Kennedy. So
it's quite a mix.
That's quite a mix. What are the chances of being on a team where everybody becomes president? Right? So yeah. We're going to start getting into some of these coincidences, because here, if I said, hey, guess what? Grandpa was best friends with this. Who was the stalker back in the murderer of in London? What was the guy's name? They called him
Jack the Ripper.
Anyway, Jack the Ripper.
Jack the Ripper.
Yeah. So if we said, hey, Grandpa was best friends with Jack the Ripper. Oh yeah. Well, Dad was best friends with Charles Manson. Oh yeah. Well, your brother was best friends with Ted Bundy. Like, what are the chances, right? Like, how do you end up in all of those places? Now, it can happen. It can happen. But again, choose what to believe. These associations where you have Prescott Bush, who's friends just one person away from Adolf Hitler, a very close person to Adolf Hitler. You have George H. Bush, who, think about this, was funding as secretly, clandestinely, and then as CIA director under Gerald R. Ford, funding Manuel Noriega, Saddam Hussein, and the Mujahideen, which is the bin Laden family, Osama bin Laden, right? When you think about those connections, and you also realize that he is very good friends with a guy by the name of George de Morenshield. He's a friend of Bush and an associate of Lee Harvey Oswald. So when we think about, well, what are the chances? Remember that it was George H. Bush's neighbor, his son, who was the person who tried to assassinate Ronald Reagan. And that's a lot of ties. And when we start getting into these, we start getting into these, like, so Hinckley's brother, Scott, was scheduled to have dinner with Neil Bush the day after the assassination attempt. You know, raising questions about just this coincidental association, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is the kind of stuff we're talking about. Like, hey, how'd it go over there trying to assassinate somebody so I can get into power, right? So now let's get into the bin Ladens just a little bit, right? Because George W. Bush was part of the, he was worked for the car with the Carlyle Group, which is this global investment firm. They had, on September 11th, 2001, included both George W. Bush and a bin Laden family member. That's why they were in the United States. I'm sorry, George H. Bush. Why they were in the United States. And they were talking about finances. Remember, there was only one airplane in the United States allowed to fly besides the president on 9/11. And that was the bin Laden family personal jet. That's it.
Is that right?
That's it. Right?
And where was it going?
So, back to Saudi. Mm-hmm. Remember, the bin Laden group is a, they're a large, they own a lot of stuff. They have a large construction company in Saudi Arabia. They agreed to rebuild parts of Mecca for $1.
And so they got plenty of money.
They got plenty of cash. They got plenty of cash. So what does all this mean? If I look back in time, I see that the Bush family is in powerful positions. Prescott was pushing for not just the CIA, but stronger UN control and organizations, global organizations. We see that George W. Bush, again, here's a guy who becomes president, but even before then, was involved in the Bay of Pigs. He was in the CIA and all of these other kind of things. What's laughable is that when he was being confirmed as the CIA director in what was it, 74 or whatever, Richard Nixon was a part of the Bay of Pigs invasion too, or planning. When you look at what was going on there, the questions from the senators were like, what kind of experience do you have? You don't even have any CIA intelligence experience. And it's like, what are you talking about? This guy's father helped form the CIA. And again, father through associations. And again, here's George W. Bush or George H. Bush working for the CIA during the time that Kennedy was president. So how did all this come to light? This is good. I'm just going to jump off here and segue into George H. Bush was being interviewed, and it was after he was president, and he was getting interviewed. And I can't remember the name of the guy. I'm going to see if I've got it written down here in my notes. Russ Baker, right? Russ Baker was interviewing him for something or other. And then he went and wrote this book about them. It's called Family of Secrets. Highly recommend it.
Yep.
So he's asking George H. Bush, hey, you know, tell us about the good times you had in the White House and what were some of the funny moments and what about that Thanksgiving dinner and yada, yada. And then one was, where were you? What were you doing on the day Kennedy was assassinated? And George H. Bush was like, oh, I don't remember. I was probably out mowing the lawn or just some nonsense. And this reporter was like, what a bunch of crap. He could tell he was faking it. And who can't remember where they were on a major event like 9/11 or, you know, when the COVID lockdowns happened, right? I mean, so he's just really like, you know, skeptical. But what we find are some documents that surface that show that George H. Bush was actually in Dallas the day of the shooting. And that the next day down in Lubbock or somewhere, Texas, he's got a meeting at the VFW. And he shows up there at 8, 9 o'clock in the morning for this meeting. And he walks in and says to everybody, I have just learned about Kennedy being assassinated because I've been traveling. I didn't know. Oh, really? You were in Dallas the day of the shooting. And you mean to tell me nobody, you never heard a thing, never saw anything? There was one report that he was actually at City Hall. And a very interesting document from the FBI that said something along the lines, and I'm going to try to find it here. I'll find it in the background. But long story short, the FBI director interviews Mr. Bush and says that he, and writes in a memo that he interviewed rogue elements of the U.S. government, and they assured him that they were not going to try to take power or some other nonsense. I mean, think about that for just a minute. If you know who to go to as a rogue element, you're the FBI director, and they assure you, and this is the day after, the Kennedy assassination. So, I'm going to look it up real quick because it's going to bother me.
So what are you saying by all that? Are you saying that, you know, perhaps there's some involvement there? How old would he have been at that time? He would have been 40-ish?
Oh, I don't know.
Let's
see here. Well, here's the document right here. It is from the director of the Bureau of Intelligence and Research, Department of State. It's to the director of Bureau of Intelligence and Research, Department of State, dated November 29th, 1963, so a couple of days after, from J. Edgar Hoover, director of the FBI. Subject is assassination of President John F. Kennedy. And he goes in and talks about you know, speaking with these rogue elements. And he says, oh, I'm sorry, it was the 22nd. He says, at 1:45 p.m., Mr. George H.W. Bush, president of the Zapata Offshore Drilling Company, Houston, Texas, they gave him the residence, etc. And he said he wanted to be kept confidential, but wanted to furnish some hearsay that he recalled hearing in recent weeks that these certain people were talking about killing the president when he comes to Houston. So here we find the Bush family saying, hey, we think we might know who did this. And here's the people, right? And they also are saying, oh, we're not them. We're not, you know, going to do anything. We're not the rogue elements. But here's the people that it might be. Well, that's mighty nice of you. So if you're, let's say for the sake of argument, that all of this is true. We've got Prescott Bush. We see who his friends are. We talk about the influence. And by the way, one of the things that needs to be mentioned is that Prescott Bush was fascinated by the Nazis. In some of the reading I've done, now get this, what he was thoughtful about and really liked was, how did the Nazis do it? Now think about this. They were a broken country. And what he sees is this amazing advancements in technology, economic boom, global superpower, right? Medical advancements, technology, all these things are happening. And it's all because they went to war. And what you see is you see this doctrine start to slip into the war college for the U.S. And you start to see this kind of moving away from the doctrine I was telling you about of total war, where you just go and you beat somebody and say, this is what you're going to do from now on. You start to see this, hey, let's make a few bucks here kind of thing. So when Kennedy is assassinated, it was in part over Vietnam, in part over they wanted to do Bay of Pigs again, and he wouldn't let them. And in part because JFK was a goody two-shoes, and he wasn't playing the global politics game. And that's where we have to worry about Trump, because he doesn't care about who has power. So he doesn't care if the Bushes want more power or have more power. He's like, we're going to do this the right way. So that makes him a target. And by the way, on the day of the assassination attempt on President Trump, then candidate Trump, it was the first time in 2 years that the Secret Service had fielded a counter sniper team with Trump. So again, we're seeing some coincidences here, right?
Yeah.
Of things that happen. But I digress. So back to the Bush family. Prescott's into, hey, we got to have a UN, and I get it. You don't want to have another Hitler kind of thing, but they see that as a way for power and money. George H. Bush, he's all into Zapata oil. They're money laundering. They're running CIA ops. They're moving stuff around. And when he's become CIA director, he's paying on the payroll of the CIA is Saddam Hussein and Manuel Noriega. So then we see these policies of each of these guys as president, obviously not Prescott, where they're very opportunist. Bush Senior or H. Bush didn't really like being in the shadows of Ronald Reagan. And so at the end of his term, he's talking about this new world order. He's involved with Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton hands off after 8 years. And by the way, under Bill Clinton, we saw the release of the fiduciary controls, i.e. the earmarks that were touted as bad and evil. But now it freed up USAID to go spend the money wherever somebody directed him to spend it. And then, of course, the police state under Bush. And we had 16 years of those guys. And we had another 8 years of Barack Obama. And then we had 4 years of Joe Biden, i.e. Barack Obama, pulling the puppet strings on a senile old man. So we've really been hamstrung for a while. Now, when you look at those type of affiliations and you look at what's going on in the Bush family and who they're friends with, and if you look at like politicalcompass.com and you look at George H. Bush, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and Joe Biden. You really don't see too many differences, like real differences. They're all globalists. They're all for diversification of power, right? Moving stuff offshore, etc. So now, as we start to get into, and we'll probably have to take 9/11 like itself on another show for time constraints. But as we start to look at that, now you can say, okay, these are the chief characters of that were there on 9/11. These are the people that were a part of it. Whether 9/11 was an inside job or not, these are the people that were there.
And it's the same old people that are involved in every same old for the last 30, 40 years.
Yep. And when you look at any of the false flag operations, and, you know, when you think about false flag operations, which is where the government puts together fake operations that are designed to sway public opinion. And you look at these, like the Bay of Pigs invasion, right?
Yeah.
But then you find, oh, wait a minute, there's a lot of false flags out there, actually. And why not at least take a look at those that we know are false flags? Known false flags. So, you know, I think that when you put things in that perspective and you get to know the people and you get to say, okay, here's the people that we're dealing with and here's what they're like. Now, I again want to point out that the Bush family, according to many reports, and there was a lawsuit, I think, in 2009 of the tribal Native Americans trying to get Sitting Bull's skull back from the Bush family because it was sitting on their mantelpiece, according to one eyewitness. And it was originally stolen as part of a skull and bones type dare of some kind, but it ended up on the Bush's mantle. Like, who puts a human skull above their fireplace? Right?
Wow. You believe that? Yeah. What's the source for that?
Well, you can go on to, so there was a lawsuit here. Let me see if I can find out when that lawsuit. Yeah. In 2000, I'm sorry, it was Geronimo, not Sitting Bull. In 2009, Geronimo's descendants filed a lawsuit against Skull and Bones, Yale University, and some others, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, seeking the return of his remains. The court dismissed it in 2010, citing lack of jurisdiction.
Wow.
And it also goes back to this Repatriation Act called NAGPRA that didn't apply retroactively before its enactment in 1990. So they didn't get into the heart of the matter, but obviously the lawyers felt like they had enough information and they could have got it. And there's a couple of videos about that, but this is the type of family we're talking about. They're known members of a secret society, the Skull and Bones. We know that George W. Bush lied to get us into a war with Iraq where 200,000 people were killed. And then he put in the Patriot Act based on all of the above. Yeah. We know that he was friends with the bin Laden family. We know that they made oil together and lots of money from it. We know that there was under George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, George H. Bush, $1 trillion that went missing. And it was announced the day before 9/11, and all of those that were a part of the investigation were killed in 9/11. So there's a whole lot of things here. Now I think we have a good understanding. We can probably close out tonight's meeting, and I can come back and talk about, now let's talk about the facts of 9/11. Because Now we know who we're dealing with. We've seen it in light of this global picture. And actually, I don't want to put too much emphasis on 9/11, because what's so different about Barack Obama conducting an airstrike on two Americans in Yemen?
Well, the number of people, but I guess for me, the troubles that I had with government have started when I was in the Army and I got sent on, boondoggles, everywhere you go, it's another boondoggle. I mean, I remember arguing with someone who had purchased with government money, purchased for our office a $30,000 conference table, of course everybody needs one, and just being devastated by that and I saw the bills because they came, you got to see them, and you go, what in the, you telling me, hell, I could have got you one of these for $2,500, probably, in the 90s, nice table, but damn, do you really need to spend all that? There was, and I know you went through this in the Army too. I was the training NCO. And so every August it would start. Every August they'd go, well, looks like we got 6 to 8 weeks left of money. And we need to spend that money. And, we got, everybody needs training. We got to get them out and get that training. We got to spend all this money and pick people to go. People that had nothing to do with that kind of training. You're teaching people to fire grenade launchers that carry typewriters. You know what I mean? And it's like, or that work in an office, and it's like, why are we doing this? Well, because the budget comes October to October, and if you don't spend it, you don't get your 3% or whatever it is automatic increase, and you certainly won't be able to ask for more, And so I have always been a questioner, when it came to the government stuff. What in the world? We would drive past Area 51 and I would go, hey, let us in to see the aliens, and stuff like that. And just, I don't know, but I never, ever thought that it was so bad that we were the ones. For me, it's a fairly new development that I believe that it's us who instigates a lot of these things. I mean, finding out, And I always suspected, I know a lot of people did, that the JFK killing was an inside job, that 9/11 probably is an inside job, that everything was a lie surrounding Iraq 1 and Iraq 2, that this Ukraine thing is just, everything's a horror story. And you're going, Jesus, has there been anything told to us in truth since?
That's true.
1980? Yeah. Anything that's really true? Is there anything that...
And I should mention that there is a video out there called JFK2, The Bush Connection. And it's pretty good. And they go into how the Bush family was connected to the JFK assassination. There's another one, I think by the same guy, that goes into... And I think it's mostly speculation, but he goes into the fact that JFK Jr. was killed or his plane fell out of the sky or whatever. Literally, when George W. Bush was only miles away campaigning. And he goes into how George W. Bush was missing for 5 or 6 hours from the campaign trail. And he postulates that George W. Bush had something to do with it. Now,
yeah, but I've heard that maybe that it had something to do with seats in New York for the Clinton monster as well.
Well, and I would say that the Bush family definitely hated the Kennedys. And the biggest thing that they hated was the truth and moral government. The truth that the Kennedys told and how they tried to have a moral government. And a moral government is nothing more than we're going to do this for the right reasons. That's all it is.
Yeah, but nobody does that anymore.
Exactly. That's when you look at the Bushes and the Clintons and the Obamas and Biden, whatever he was coherent enough to do, but it was Hillary and Pelosi and Biden and Obama that were running the show when Biden was quote unquote president. And all they were doing is telling lies. Think about this. Last year at this very time, we were still being lied to. This is after the Democrat Party manipulated its own primaries so that Biden would win. We were still getting from the press, quote unquote, these parrots. We were still getting from them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were getting from them. Oh, there's nothing to see here. And now, by the way, just this last week, they were trying to pretend like, oh, we missed this. No, you didn't miss it. You didn't miss it. You were deliberately misleading the rest, trying to mislead the rest of us. So they were lying to us then. They were lying to us about the manipulation of the elections in 2020. And I'm not talking about Biden versus Trump. I'm talking about the fact that guys like Bernie Sanders and Andrew Yang couldn't proceed in the primaries because it was being manipulated behind the scenes by Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. They were moving the chess pieces around. So they don't care if we get a vote. In fact, they don't think we deserve a vote. Look what happens when we vote. We get Trump. And they don't like it. Right? And so what did they do? Like, we just had an announcement here in Illinois that Senator Dick Durbin isn't going to seek a 950th term, right, as senator.
Yeah.
And guess what happened? And this is nothing to the Democrats at all. Nothing at all. The governor of Illinois, right, a billionaire, steps up and says, I'm choosing so and so. Here's who needs to be senator. Well, what the crap? Do you think we should have a primary and then an election, or is this just where you get up and choose who you want to be there? So, well, they are used to that. They don't trust us, and as we saw with well, we've seen it with all of them. I shouldn't just say we've seen it with Bush, but they don't care about human life. They don't care about leaving $80 billion of equipment in Afghanistan. They don't care about any of it. What they do care about is keeping us busy fighting while they do all the stuff. All this stuff about gay marriage and then transgender and all this nonsense keeps us all fighting while they're doing whatever they want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And if you actually uncover what they're doing, and well, this is one of the other things that came out. And by the way, this was made popular by George W. Bush. One of the first things he said after 9/11 is, let's not have too many of these conspiracy theories out there.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, because we can't have conspiracy theories. We can't have people really finding out the truth. That would not be good.
It's not the truth. It's a conspiracy theory. If you call the truth a conspiracy theory, that's what it becomes if you call it that enough. And, you know, I was before you came on the show, I was doing my little preamble there. And I was talking about it, this happened tonight, in fact. And I was at a bath house in a sauna with a family, Russian speaking, from Moldova. And you know, they were trying to pressure me into saying something about the war in Ukraine. And I only do that on my radio program. I generally won't talk about it with people on the street because you're likely to end up in a fight, you know, or something like that. Mm-hmm. And he was asking me, and he was pressuring me. We were sitting in a hot tub, and then he's just kept pressuring. And I said, well, what do you think, you know, what's Putin going to do and how's that going to go? And we talked for a few minutes, and he says, yeah, but isn't America doing the right thing? And I said, I'm going to tell you something from an American perspective. I said, this is an American perspective right here. And if this is what you're after, I'm going to tell it to you. And I said, the big shocker for me was something I alluded to you a little while ago, was that our country and our government always used to think, and I said, I always used to think that we were special. We grew up thinking we were special. Our country was special. Our structure was special. Our democracy was special. Our military was all powerful. We were the
moral... But look at what kids are taught today. It's not the same thing. The opposite, right?
Well, I agree.
Literally taught the opposite.
That I know.
Columbus was a criminal, misogynist. Yep, a criminal. Yep. And that all of our traditions are steeped in hatred, that the American flag is symbolic of you know, these type of things, and that socialism is the best way. And they've done a good job of convincing, like, 40% of Americans that, oh, yeah, we should be socialist, and we're not
exceptional. Yeah, I know. I know. Where's my free stuff? Where's my free stuff? And by the way, if all things are equal, you know, why not? I mean, if everybody's equal, and some are just more equal than others, let those that are more equal than others do the same thing they're doing right now and control the world, as long as they take care of the rest of us that aren't, you know, aren't that equal. If we all get the same BS and those people get to be rich and fly around, do things they want. Well, finishing up on what my point was with the story to this guy, he says, yeah. I said, how long have you been here? Asked him what he thought. He had lived in Washington State, said he really liked it. And then here he is in Florida. And he said, here, you have to come here with a lot of money because otherwise, you know, you can't do it. I said, Jesus, you're saying that. And you thought it was great to live in Washington State. That place is expensive as hell too. But anyway, I said, he's going, you know, I said, as far as the war goes, as far as everything over there on the Eastern Europe is, that over the last 30 years, I have watched my belief structure just get whittled away into nothing. The beliefs that the things that I held dear, that we are superior, we are great, and you just keep watching it, them pick away and pick away. And then this is what I said to him. I said, you know, and because I had been in Moldova, I was telling him about my trip to Moldova, where I watched all the aid that we delivered over a 3-4 month period instantly get resold on at the little markets on Saturday and Sunday afternoons. You'd go down there, all the crap you just delivered and were passing out to help the people was being sold by the people who you delivered it to on the street to other people for premium dollars. And I'm going, man, what in the world are we doing here? And it just whittled away and whittled away. And my final point to the guy was, look, the problem I have now is that the America that I knew and loved, I wonder if it still exists. Now, I have a lot of belief that Trump is trying to go back, like some of the things that you've said, to go back and rebuild it. I said, but the depressing part for me was the fact that he would have to in the first place, and that we are just in as bad a shape as every other country on the planet, with all the people that are good people. You know, people are good people, and their governments are crap.
We celebrate mediocrity. We celebrate, right? We get the, if you look at the rise of the Jerry Springer mentality back during the, again, during the Clinton years, let's parade the absurdities of the dregs of society, right? And then let's make it okay for everybody to be like that. Let's get people to aspire to it. Like, I don't know if it's true or not, but the story of the high heels on Chinese women, where the high heels came from, is that these women would be, you know, caught for prostitution or something, and so they would make them wear high heels down the street, you know, and actually they became, you know, more of a status symbol. Like you see these guys walking around with saggy pants that their underwear is showing. Well, from what I understand, that started in the prison system as like, hey, I'm available kind of thing. But when you get out on the street, and sometimes these things get twisted. So at the end of the day, if I were to look at this in terms of, again, change, how much can a country change and still be the same country? And it goes back to, if our social norms have pivoted, if the economy is now driven externally or through other factors than what it was before, if our government is no longer run the way that we expect it to be run, if, I mean, you just keep going down the list, right? If you go through every aspect of society, from demographics, right, which is they're trying to change the demographics as well. Let's just bring in everybody, like we did the 16% demographic shift in Germany and the massive shift we saw in Sweden and up in Canada. We want to get rid of this Western way of thinking. We want to merge it into something else so that we can have power.
Yeah, white conservative beliefs are gone.
Well, yeah, and that's why you see Barack Obama saying, oh, these people are clinging to their God and guns, right? My own personal belief, having lived in Norway and speaking the language, when I saw that Barack Obama, as a new president, was being awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo, Norway. What did they say at that time? They said, well, it's not for what he's done, it's for what he's about to do. Okay, well, let's look and see what he did then. And everything he did was, in my view, not beneficial to America, or at least minimal benefits to America. Most of the benefits were external, were in pivoting the nation, reducing the GDP, the growth of it anyway, reducing our social norms, all of those things in favor of global assimilation. So were the Norwegians wrong? Well, from their perspective, they're like, oh, this is great for the world. Yeah, but it's un-American. And that's why they talk down about America. I am not proud of America, is what, you know, Barack's quote-unquote wife would say. And so at the end of the day, we have a bunch of people. Now, again, I'm going to use the term globalist just because it's people who are in favor of a global order. I myself am in favor of a global order. We need to have order around the globe. However, I think there needs to be a convincing of the people. Talk to the people. Take your case to them. Let the ideas be floated. Talk about the problems and bring it up instead of creating secret societies and hiding what you're going to do and keeping power and, you know, hooking up your friends and all this stuff.
Well, it'd be okay if everybody could create their own secret society and everybody had a fair chance to have their secret society be the one that was, selected to rule the world. You know, me and you could start a secret society tomorrow and just decide that, hey, maybe we'll do, you know why we can't? We don't have that kind of money. You need that $1 trillion that you stole from the Pentagon and hid among 10 families.
Well, yeah,
somewhere.
You got friends in USAID that are going to funnel your 501c3 $18 billion, and then you put a bunch of your friends on the payroll, and you're all buying private jets and everything else. You got time to run around and do social engineering. You got time for that crap.
And connect with people who make decisions, because you got all the money. And so the rest of us can just sit around and bitch on radio programs, you know. And I'm not so sure that we can do a whole lot about it.
Well, I think that's the importance of telling the truth, right? And letting people, again, as I said at the beginning, you only have one choice, and that's what to believe. Everything after that is what you do with that belief. And so I think it's what I like about what's happening in the world today is that at least we can talk about these two sides, but we need to talk accurately about it. We need to understand the past, and then we need to be able to say, hey, look, this world order, that is this shift that's happening now, it's probably going to settle after the next presidential term, whoever that is. A lot of people are saying it would be Vance, but who knows? You know, the globalists and, you know, these people have shifted power in their favor before, and right now, everything that Trump's doing, they're going to make the most of it, right? They really are.
Yeah,
and you can see it in just the narratives that are out there.
Oh, I'm already reading them. I see them.
Oh, yeah. And so the choice then becomes ours of what to believe, and I would say we need to study, and then we need to look ahead to the future and say, what am I going to be doing? Who am I going to be? How am I going to do it 8 years from now? In, you know, the early 2030s. And that needs to be our real push, because, you know, we've got new tools out there that can help with this. We don't have to just rely on one person, one vote, or a commentary, as you put it, on a radio station. So I would encourage everyone to begin exerting influence how they can, where they can, to who will listen, and let them believe what they will. Right? Let them believe.
Yeah,
what
but
they
people
will.
people are not opinion friendly these days.
That's a skill set we've got to develop. That's part of that deep thinkers that you and I talked about last time. We need to develop that skill set with our friends and family. And that's the other thing they've taken away from us, I might add.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you say anything, it's easy to just label you. And then all of a sudden, conversation shuts down. Or people
yep,
get
conversation's done. He's a Putin apologist. I don't know
there's
what.
There's labels. There's plenty of labels for you, and then we can shut you down.
He's a racist. Yep. He can't even spell the word black. You know, it's.
Do you remember the during the Biden years, the kids at the universities that were just screaming at people? There's no coherent conversation. They're just screaming. And then the universe is like, oh, we've got these poor kids that are they're having anxiety attacks.
They need safe space.
Kids accountable.
Yep. They need safe spaces built for them. And
yeah.
Well, Matthew, I appreciate you being on again tonight. And I'd like you to finish next week and join me again and see if we can't get to the the 9/11, I think you've done a good job of getting us a good, healthy background. And then I find it hard to believe after a couple of things that I've watched that you sent to me that more people, and maybe more people have, and I'm just late to the party, I don't know, but that people don't watch or pay attention to the things that are generally known now, and they've been hidden for a long time. But it's pretty sad when people can finally come out of the closet and tell you something or allow the truth to be put out there, you know, because before, you know, it was not, you'd immediately be attacked. Now it's just presumed you're a quack if you say any of the things that you
they've done a good job. And that, again, that was Bush that hooked that up for us. Hey, you know, let's start hammering the people that are going to tell the truth. Let's make it a social crime for them to speak, so that nobody will listen to them, so that they will be the ones that are, you know, ostracized.
That are ostracized and harmed and destroyed politically, you know, emotionally, family, professionally, you know, whatever. It's they have no problem destroying people. Well, I'm going to finish up the show. We got to be off in a few here, and I've got a couple things I want to finish up. We'll get together sometime this weekend. I'll give you a call, and we'll try to arrange something for next week. And I appreciate you very much. Thank you, Mr. Matthew
Sounds
Von
good.
Trapp.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, yep. Thanks you for having me. Have a good night.
Yep, you too. Bye. And there he goes. Well, I have always enjoyed speaking with him. I told you before that when I relocated to Qatar, he was showed me the ropes, helped me out, introduced me to some people. Heck, he even helped me find my job over there. That was, you know, with some of the people that he was connected with and he knew. I think I'd like to go back there. I mean, it's a pretty cool country and well worth the trip. And but he knows a lot of stuff, and I've always liked the way he puts things together. He's always been pretty organized, and I enjoy listening to him. So I'm glad he was able to join us. I don't think I'm going to go too much further into it, but I did find this thing he was talking about, and I'll see if I can real quickly get there, just a couple of minutes. Geronimo's Air, this is a New York Times article from February 19, 2009, Houston. The descendants of Geronimo have sued the Skull and Bones, a secret society at Yale with ties to the Bush family. I'm going to pull this up on a lawsuit somewhere and read it. Charging that its members robbed his grave in 1918 and have kept his skull in a glass case ever since. The claim is part of a lawsuit filed in federal court in Washington on Tuesday, the 100th anniversary of Geronimo's death. The Apache warrior's heirs are seeking to recover his remains wherever they may be and have them transferred to a new grave at a headwaters of the Gila River in New Mexico, where Geronimo was born and wished to be interred. I believe strongly from my heart that his spirit was never released, Geronimo's great-grandson, Harlan Geronimo, 61, told reporters Tuesday at the National Press Club. Geronimo died a prisoner of war at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, 1909. Long-standing tradition among members of Skull and Bones holds that Prescott S. Bush, father of President George Bush and grandfather of President George W. Bush, broke into the grave with some classmates during World War I and made off with the skull, two bones, a bridle, and some stirrups, all of which were put on display at the group's clubhouse in New Haven, known as the Tomb. Very interesting stuff. I never knew that story. So we learn something interesting every day. That is going to be about it for the end of the program. And I encourage you to, JR is allowing me to do the show live at 9 p.m. And then while we transition to the 9 o'clock, he's allowing it to be replayed at the 4 o'clock hour in Missouri. And so you can actually, if you didn't get to hear this, you can listen to it Friday on the 2nd of May. And hope you enjoy it all. I definitely enjoyed being here. I appreciate all of you listening to the program and supporting Dam Radio. Dam Radio is brought to you by Jonathan Hartenstein, a good friend and a good man. And he's doing a great thing here. Keep on listening to us. Thank you so very much. And y'all have a very good evening.